Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing World's in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show.
I think that we are live now. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening to anyone who may be watching live now or later on. I've got the absolute pleasure of being joined once again by the Queen of the Elderlings herself to discuss the Tony Mann trilogy by Robin Hobb. So Derry, thank you very much for coming again.
You are very welcome. I love coming to talk to you. It's great fun. And, you know, I've said this to many people, I will never turn down the chance to talk about these books. It doesn't matter. It's like, yeah, I'll totally be there. Totally.
Yeah, as is made clear, because I was having a look-see around your channel, and you've got a you've got a playlist of collaborations of all the you are the go-to person when it comes to Elderlings. You are the factotum there.
Well, I like the talking to people about these books is absolutely the best thing about these books, because there is so much to discuss. I mean, all of those collaborations that I've sort of piled up with, so few things have been discussed more than once, because there's just so much to talk about. And I want to sort of spread that and go, look at how much you can take from this and how many different lenses you can look at things and how different everybody's experience can be and still be a really enjoyable series. I love that. I love it just so much. Yeah.
Although I had a quick look around again about, there seemed to be a lot of conversations around the first trilogy.
Yes.
There seemed to be a fair but lesser amount of conversations around Lifeship Traders. And that seems to die. That's where the whole conversation seems to die. There doesn't seem to be that much discussion around Tony Mann or the later sort of beats of the series.
BookTube has been slow to catch up with me. And so as people are reading, suddenly, okay, now there are more people who I can talk to about it, but often they wait until they've finished the entire series. So there's more on the whole series than I've got for Tawny Man and Rain Wilds, right, or even Fits in the Fall. But that will change as more people get more familiar with it. More people will want to talk about specific things.
Before we dive into Tawny Man, there is a little matter of The Willful Princess and the Pieble Prince, right? That little novella set in the realm of the Elderlings, which I haven't read. Mm-hmm. But from earlier conversations, if anyone is thinking or is currently reading Elderlings, probably somewhere between Lifeship and Tawny Man would be the time to read Willful Princess, right?
Yeah, I think it's when you're going to get the most value from it. I mean, it's a great story, a little story all on its own, and it is tiny. Like it's other side, it's little, like it's really little. So it's like a one maybe two sitting story, and it's really good on its own merits. But what it does is it sets up the conversations that you're going to end up having in Tawny Man around the wit and the old blood. And it gives you a really embedded sense of why this is such an abhorrent magic to people and why the response to it is so negative and so visceral. And it just gives it so much context that when you read Tawny Man, it just makes more sense, rather than suddenly there's this, you know, outrage about wit or that seemingly out of nowhere, because up until now, really all we've seen is Burrick being very anti-witted and Fitz being killed for it.
Mm.
So, but this sort of gives you that background.
Yeah, because I think I may have learned my lesson. And now that I'm doing the Sun Eater series, there's a couple of novellas that slot between some of the books. And usually I'm fairly like, if it's not part of the core series, you know, I already have limited time to read. But after my experience with this particular book, there's a couple of novellas in Sanita that I want to read at the right time. And they may not have the same impact that, not even impact, but context that probably Willful Princess offers to Tournyman.
Mm.
But I suppose
you can read it without reading Tournyman without that novella. It can be done. It's not you don't miss any information. You just lose the depth of the context.
That's right. And I think if you're going to dive into immerse yourself into a 14 book series, what's a little novella there? It's not going to harm you, and it's just probably going to make the experience that little bit richer, right?
Exactly the word I would have used. Definitely.
Right. So we got that out of the question, and then woe betide anyone. Right now, I'm going to say Tournyman trilogy for me was the weakest point in the whole.
Okay.
I know.
But let me tell you, Jose.
Let me tell you why. Let me give you my reasons, and then you can tell me where I'm wrong. Okay.
You're not wrong for having an opinion.
No. So here's the thinking. Most people, and I was most people. You read Fitz and the Fool, and you go. In my case, well, that was a pretty rubbish ending, but I love these two characters. Like, I really love Fitz and the Fool. I want to continue with them. I want to know what happens to them. And then in between Farcia and Tournyman, you got that weird Lifeship Traders, which has got nothing to do with Fitz and the Fool. And you go, oh, should I read it? Should I not read it? Oh. And in the end, I go, okay, I'm going to read it. Thank God I did, right? Because I think Lifeship is absolutely, I think it's probably...
It's a spectacular trilogy.
It's a 9 out of 10, just because giving a 10 would be, I don't know. Anyway, so then finally, we come back to Fitz and the Fool. So we've gone through, and you know, Lifeship, they're fairly chunky books, all three of them.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got that waiting time. You get to Fitz and the Fool, and it doesn't quite, for me, live up to the expectations.
Okay.
And I felt a little bit disappointed with it. Reason being, the first book in the trilogy is almost a standalone story.
Yep.
I finished reading the first book in Tournyman, and I went, okay, like, that's the story done. that you know.
Yeah.
It
closes. It is a complete little story. Oh, I've lost your sound. We've had nothing from you since I said it's a complete story, but that's okay. Hi, Jennifer, in the chat. It's good to see you. I don't know how I'm going to go with a conflicting opinion on Tournyman, but I'm pretty sure that it's a question of expectations versus reality. As to where we go from there, I don't know. I hope that Jose at least is enjoying it. Let's have a look. No, still very, I don't know if it's me or Jose. Oh, there we go. He's going to reload. There we go. But yes, I wonder sometimes if the hype for Tournyman hurts it. Because there's only so much you can say about, yes, it's great, yes, it's amazing, and have people be okay with that. Are you back with us? Oh, maybe. No, still no sound, my friend. But that's okay. I can still keep going. We're good. I know a lot of people are like, fool's errand, nothing happens. And to be fair, they're right. Half of the book is literally half of the book. He's in a cabin and we're getting slice of life. So we can try that again, it looks like. But I like the slice of life. The slice of life at Fool's Errand for me was the welcome back. It was, I feel home. You've come back to your friends. You're like, okay, let's have a catch up. What have you been up to? What have you been doing? And you get those emotional reconnections with, you know, the characters from Farcia, where Fitz hasn't seen these people for 15 years, with the sole exception of Starling. And she's his only contact with the world. And it's very, this is Fitz with no external driving factors. And it's pretty calm and it's pretty settled and it's kind of boring. And he worries about his chickens. Night Eyes is really happy though. Night Eyes is like, yeah, this is pretty great, actually. Then, of course, you know, the series opens with he came to my door and brought the world with him, because Shade shows up and time of change is upon them. And so you get that sense of inevitability that he's going to get drawn back into it. But it takes, you know, a good half of the book to actually kick off and start to go somewhere. And it was, yeah, it was, yeah, I agree, Jennifer. It does change very, very much the pace, because they're very different styles of trilogy. As you say, The Live Ships is absolutely one contained story over three books. You know, Tawny Man starts with that sort of welcome back, and
right,
moves on in the second two books, sorry, in the second and third books, to do what Royal Assassin and Assassin's Quest did in Farcia, which is actually, oh, okay, now we're going to do the thing. So, okay. Oh, I hear you. This is good.
Yeah, okay. Am I here then? Sorry, I'm just trying.
You are here. You're a little quiet, yeah, but you're here.
Okay, hang on. I don't want to mess this up, so hold on. And am I around?
Look at that.
Am I here?
Well done. You're yes. Here.
Okay, so I don't quite know what is happening with the world. All right, so hang on, more or less. That there may be the best I can do for now. Sorry. I don't know why.
That's all right.
On the computer, all of a sudden the internet doesn't work, but on the iPad, everything is okay. So I just need to get myself in the picture.
Technology. Can't be trusted.
So irritating.
Technical troubles, everybody.
Jesus.
We all have them.
What is it they say on television? This is the risks of live broadcasting, isn't it?
That's right.
Right, okay. So we're here now. I'm back.
We are.
Sorry, I left you there. I was saying, yeah, so that first book, it's a self-contained story.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like after that, where is this going?
Well, and then
the story after, it's not great.
Oh, my heart. Okay. I wonder often if the hype hurts Tawny Man. And again, I come back to, if you don't love Fitz, it's really hard to love this whole series because Fitz is the core of it. I find that people who are okay with Fitz in Farcia love Live Ships, come back, and because they've become more familiar with Hobbs' style, it's somehow easier for them to come back and connect more deeply with Fitz. And then Fitz isn't a teenager anymore. Thank God, because he was a painful teenager.
Yeah, but now
he's an adult. And so he's looking back and going, I was a bit of a dick. And trying to do better and trying to behave not as ridiculously. He doesn't always succeed, but he's easier to be around. And so in Tawny Man, anyone who's kind of okay on Fitz usually comes around. And by the time you get to the end of Tawny Man, that emotional dig, which is really why we read Hob, has really got itself embedded. Is the story the strongest? Well, I like to think so, but I've read it a lot. But for me, it's the characters, always the characters. And so, that story is amazing.
That trilogy, like you said, is hot. It's got fantastic character work. And I think probably the relationships are a little bit, I mean, they're even better executed than they were in Farseer. So the relationship between Fitz and Hap, his adopted son, and sort of the friction they go through when Hap sort of grows up and wants to become independent and that sort of thing. So that's very well done. We have that weird relationship between Fitz and the name of the bard,
Starling.
Starling. I was going to say Starbreeze, but that's from a different series. So, Starling, yeah, which at the beginning, you know, and probably again, this trilogy was written when? Easily?
This was the early 2000s.
You know, she's talking about Starling having almost this sort of open marriage where it's okay. But, you know, again, Robin Hood being ahead of her time when talking and dealing with issues around sexuality and gender. And then obviously this trilogy definitely then dives well into the sexuality of the Fool, isn't it?
That's when
it's the trilogy where they have that conversation about loving
each other. It becomes the argument.
And you know, just because you love someone doesn't mean you want to.
That's right. You know, love is more than plumbing is ultimately the key phrase for all of Fitz and the Fool, where you can love somebody and you can love somebody truly deeply and not want to bed them. And that was something that Fitz didn't grasp for such a long time. And when he did finally grasp it was when he'd already so badly emotionally hurt the Fool that it was almost impossible to come back from. But I liked the way that argument was handled, because even the loveliest people can struggle with a concept they just can't grasp. That's just how understanding works. You have to come to it on your own. And Fitz did. He's a little slow, but that's not surprising to anyone who's met him.
Yeah, I just think that the whole sort of human aspect, relationship side of things, Robin Hood is masterful at that. Mm. The actual story of the, because again, we get deeper into the whole, the prophet and the catalyst thing and so on.
Yeah.
Because we have this situation where again, I don't know if I'm mixing now with the Fitz and the Fool trilogy now, everything is sort of now one in my mind. You know, there's every generation or every age has got its prophet and the catalyst, and the next prophet doesn't come along until the previous one has completed or failed or whatever. But we have this other fool-like creature, is it
Prilcop,
around still.
Yeah.
And so that whole thing was going on. And then the final bit just annoyed me, because to me it reeked a little bit of like childish Dungeons and Dragons, where we go to this frozen island in the North Sea and there's an evil queen witch that has got a fortress under the ice. And me, that felt like really childish and like something I would have done when I was 13 years old, you know, running a Dungeons and Dragons campaign for my friends. It just felt, for me, that detracted from the appearance of the story.
I liked that whole part of it, because when we get there, we realise it's actually an elderling city that she's taken over. And that plays into the bigger themes of the series. And the sense of wanting to destroy came across really clearly there, because she's taken over this place of beauty and place of grace and literally shit all over it. And that that just the wanton destruction of something beautiful being a bad thing is clear, and it's a very blatant kind of dig. But I thought it was done quite cleverly, in that there was a reason for why she was there. There was a reason why that was the place where all of these things were going to become key to changing the path of the future. It made sense to me. It felt like a crossroads within the world where things were going to happen. Whether that ever plays out in later books, I don't know, but I very much feel that the separate centres of Elderlings are important, because Ashlyfjall is clearly an important Elderling place with so many of the memory stones, so much of the like the map table with the pillars all shown, is really only equaled by Kelsingra that we explore later, and we saw briefly in Farseer, which again had the big map table markings on where the pillars were. For me, that tells me there's more to the Elderling story, that Ashlyfjall is such a big centre, despite the fact it's in the icy north. So on the deeper level of the story, I really liked that. As on just a surface reading, yes, it's this, you know, Winter Fortress, Winter Queen, she's pale, she's all of the associated imagery with Winter Queen. And for me, it also, yes, it also because Fall had visions of himself there and how his story was going to go there, it explains why back in Farseer, being cold was something he couldn't stand, because he's always known that the outcome of Tawny Man was his fate. So disliking the cold, hating anything to do with the cold, feeling incredibly vulnerable when he's cold, suddenly that has more meaning. And so now in this story, we've added value to the previous story just on that one thing. So I always manage to get more with the more I read it. And every time I read it, I come further away from that surface read of Winter Queen, Fortress, Dragon, the thing.
Maybe. Because the other thing I had some difficulty getting over with, we'll get back to that in a minute. Just to address Jennifer's point here. But again, I don't know if I'm going too much into Fitz and the Fool, but to me, this whole, throughout the series, wanting to bring the dragons back into the world, because we saw how the dragons behave in Lightship, when Tintaglia finally arrives. It seemed like sort of fairly nihilistic, and it wouldn't make sense for humans to want dragons back in the world. Without dragons, humans are the masters of the world. With the dragons, they become servants to the dragons. Why would they want to do that?
This is a fairly common thing, actually, that people say, and I have to remind people all the time, bringing dragons back was not the goal. Making the world better is the goal. The fact that all of the paths that lead to better outcomes go via bringing back dragons is secondary. They are part of the pathway to a better world. And it stops the way I look at it, dragons stop the most aggressive tendencies of those in power. You're going to have far less land acquisition style behaviours from rulers. They are going to have to learn to get along. Merely to come up against dragons, you know, we have to be a united front here about the dragons. And in bringing back the dragons, you also bring back elderlings. And in bringing back the elderlings, you bring back not only a sense of magic, but a lot of learning. Because they're so long lived, they learn a lot. And they were behind so much of the technology that was lost when elderlings died. They were behind things like the lights that they didn't need to burn things for. They had magical means of doing that. So all of these things make the world better. The ability to use memory stones. I mean, how different is that if you're learning medicine? You can read stuff in a book, but that is not the same as learning what goes into that book. But if you can sit there with a memory stone and go, okay, yep, downloaded that, and have that knowledge, like that true understanding of what went into learning, that's a good thing. that's the advantage to having elderlings, is being able to develop and learn and save all of that knowledge. So that's a bettering of the world. There's also to be considered, dragons and elderlings didn't die out naturally. This wasn't an evolutionary thing. You know, there was stuff goes on that you find out later, but it wasn't a natural end. So these creatures, this balance belongs in the world. They're supposed to be there.
Although, so
it's, yeah.
Because when you said that, I just made the connection, because it reminded me a little bit of the argument in the Watchmen comic by Alan Moore, where Ozymandias conjures up a common threat.
Yes.
Do you not? And then sort of we question the morality of that in Watchmen.
Yep.
But here we hail it as
it leads to because it's being approached just that little bit differently. And where the common threat is, I don't know, more nuanced, obviously, but the coming together has to happen on such a basic level. Long live white, yes, that's often what fantasy tells us, is if we look long term, if we try and solve long term goals, everybody's going to be happier. And the dragons, again, some of the answers to the problems people have with the dragons in Tawny Man get answered in Rain Wilds, and some of it gets answered in Fits in the Fall. Mm. It's part of the story, Tawny Man. It's a big part of the story, and most of the story gets wrapped up in Tawny Man. But there are so many questions that you don't realise you have until you read further and you go, oh, I didn't know I still needed to know that. But I needed to know that, because now that makes sense. So it's.
But to address Jennifer's point here, is that typically in fantasy stories, the elves are jealous of the humans because the humans are short-lived. They're a lot more passionate about what they do, and they achieve greater things because they are driven by that ambition, because the lifespans are so short, whereas, you know, typically in Lord of the Rings and Dragonlance, the elves are very passive about the world, and they don't get as involved, and they never reach the peaks of sort of power or whatever you want that the humans do, because they lack that drive. Because, hey, you know, what's 10 years to us?
Yeah. It's just
a fleeting moment.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's an interesting point. Like I was saying before, the one thing I had some issues accepting was how quickly the people of the Six Duchies were willing to make peace with the
Out Islanders.
Because after the Horrid War and everything that happened in Farseer trilogy, it seemed like it's a short time to then build ties and pretend that everything is okay, and, you know, try to be besties and join together.
It is a short time to some degree, but it's also a generation.
Yes.
When you consider it's 15 years, it's okay. It's not probably not quite a whole generation, but it is a generation. And the interactions between the Six Duchies and the Out Islanders really only happened on the coast. And within those communities, there were Out Islanders who had fled the Out Islands and wanted to fight them as well. So they were never quite the monolithic force that I think is necessary to really embed that kind of genetic distaste. Most people in the Six Duchies before the Red Ship War were happy to admit to having family in the Out Islands. There were strong ties, there was strong trading that went on. So yes, the Red Ship War was horrible, but it was also 3, maybe 4 years, and it only got really bad in the last 2. So it's a fairly short spanned war, and it was limited to the coast. where, yes, it interrupted trade. Yes, it interrupted a lot of coming and going between the six duchies and Chalced and Bingtown and Jamalia. But it also only impacted those people on the coast.
As always, very fair points, yes. And we also find out a little bit sort of what motivated that red sheep war in the first place, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important, given how quickly it gets tied up at the end of Farseer, that we get that, oh, okay, this is what was actually going on. And yeah.
Yeah, but you see, because we've talked about it before, that sort of very rushed ending of Farseer, it only makes sense if you carry on reading.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's almost like doing it a disservice, because I've grown to appreciate Farseer more the more I've read
yes.
Elderlings, whereas I think when I finished Farseer, I did a video ranking like my favorite fantasy series, and Elderlings came pretty low because it was just on Farseer and that rushed ending and that sort of, well, we don't even follow the hero, and you know, we lack a lot of the motivations and the points and the whys and the reasons.
Yeah.
And only as you read on that you go, oh, okay. Mm. And then my appreciation for Elderlings has moved up over time.
Yeah. Yeah. So much context is given in the later books that it rewards a reader for continuing. It's like, oh, you've kept going. Awesome. Thanks. Here's some extra that will make you enjoy everything you already read. Some more. It absolutely rewards the reader who keeps going. The other thing is, because the story sort of grew as it was being told, there are absolutely elements that were brought in early that just don't get brought back until much later, because that's just how big epic stories go to some degree. Knowing, as I do, having watched so many of Robin Hobb's discussions and interviews, knowing that The Fool was only intended to come on, issue a garbled prophecy and never be seen again, blows my mind when you consider that The Fool becomes such a key person in the whole series. To discover that there were no plans to return to the Six Duchies and that The Liveship Traders was going to be a completely separate series blew my mind. Until the character of Amber shows up and the author is like, oh, this is where you went. Okay, this is now part of this story. And then needing to bring that together in Tawnyman to say, okay, this was where the story was going. I didn't know that's where the story was going when I started, but this is where it's going. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, she took a break after Tawnyman. She wrote Soldier Son trilogy, and that wasn't received particularly well because it wasn't Fitz and the Fool, and everybody wanted more Fitz and the Fool. And when she did return, it was to start a new set of arcs in the Rainwild Chronicles. And I've started using the comparison. It's like reading A Feast for Crows after reading A Storm of Swords. It's like, we've got all new characters. I don't care about these people. Why are we even here? And it's such a drop in pace after you've had that really climatic kind of conclusion of an arc, which is what we got in Tawnyman. And then we head into the Rainwild Chronicles, which adds so much context to everything. Much context.
I think I may have mentioned this to you before in our previous conversations, but I felt that her best two characters are Fitz and the Fool.
Yeah.
But her best plots happen
are in the other.
Yeah. And it's kind of like irritating, isn't it? You almost want Fitz and the Fool to have been the main characters in Liveship Traders. That would have been like the perfect fantasy trilogy.
Maybe. I don't know if I could have coped with more impact in Fitz's stories. That's a lot. And let's be fair, if somebody writes the perfect fantasy book, that would probably be it. And then everything after that is disappointing. Yeah. Which is tragic. So, you know.
Knowing when to stop is always difficult, isn't it?
That's right. But Tawny Man for me was just a beautiful wrap up of the themes in Liveships and the themes in Farseer, because we're doing what Fool says he's trying to stop, the cycles of repeating behaviors. Because you see, you mentioned it with Fitz, with Hap, and that relationship as a, you know, an adoptive father to a son, which we saw with Burrick and Fitz himself in Farseer. And you see the same mistakes. You see Hap getting into a relationship that's just doomed to failure. You see the frustration in Fitz trying to make him see that, no, focus on your apprenticeship, son. Do the thing that's actually going to help you in the long term. In the same way that Burrick was like, oh, don't be doing this. Just no, oh, don't, please don't, don't. And you're doing it. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of men raising other men's children. Because we see Nettle from afar being fathered by Burrick. We see Dutiful, who isn't being fathered by anybody because Verity isn't there. Mm. And he's the one that breaks the cycle. He's the child who doesn't then pass any of that trauma on because he hasn't lived with a father that isn't his father. That breaking of cycles is the point of Fitz. And who was it? Kettle said in Assassin's Quest, nobody said the catalyst was going to be great. Nobody said he was going to be smart. Nobody said he was going to be a hero. And ultimately, it's when Fitz is being an idiot and causing mistakes and causing chaos that things change to the better.
So. Yeah. I mean, and the other big thing that sort of, again, I think it's dealt more, we get more closure on that in Fitz and the Fool, is the relationship between Fitz and Queen Ketuken.
Yes.
Because it's sort of, this is a spoiler conversation. I think we find out later on that kind of Ketuken knew all along that it was Fitz that night up in the mountains. And that sort of, that relationship between the two of them, how, I suppose, you know, Ketuken was always like that. She was the, what was it, the sacrifice for her?
Yes.
She did the right thing all along and never really sort of revealed the truth of Beautiful's conception and
all that
sort of stuff. And there's always this sort of underlying tension whenever Fitz and Ketuken are on the same page, isn't it?
Yeah. And I like it. I like it a lot because I think that as a character, Ketuken is just so much goodness that really we should be annoyed by her. You know, she should come across as a Mary Sue because where does she go wrong, really? She's such an amazing character. And, yes, she's so easy to admire. And characters that we love and admire her. Verity loved her. Night Eyes thought she was the bee's knees. You know, these are characters whose opinions matter. So, yes, we love Ketuken. The fact that Fitz is such an idiot and never even considers that someone else might like him, he's so focused on Molly, is frustrating as a reader. Because I'm like, Fitz, come on. This woman is amazing. She would totally go there with you. And he just never, he's just like, really, Fitz, come on.
Yeah.
And again, we do eventually, we see that Fitz just literally doesn't feel this for Ketuken, but he carries the memories. He carries the emotional weight of Verity's love for Ketuken and of Night Eyes' love for Ketuken. So while he doesn't love Ketuken that way, he carries that love that other people have for her. And I think that that makes it such a beautifully nuanced relationship. However tragic it is for Ketuken. It's like, you never saw me. It's poignant in its beauty, which is what Hobb does best.
Yeah.
You know, that the happy ending isn't always actually what's going to make the story come to fruition.
That's right. And I think it was also in this trilogy where we have Fitz interacting through the dreaming with his daughter,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And then, again, it's one of those things that you get a payoff four books later.
Yeah, you really do.
Because I think it's here at the end of Toliman when he goes back to Molly, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, the final few chapters describe the next couple of years as he woos her by letter and does that, which not everybody's a fan of. It took me a while to be okay with it.
Well, it's probably a tough one to swallow when maybe just due to circumstances, Molly and Burrick get together at yeah. the end of Parcia, and it's just out of necessity. But the fact that they have so many children hints that there was something more than, or that something grew.
Oh, absolutely. There clearly was a love there. Yeah.
Just the necessity of the time.
Yeah.
For him to come back in.
I struggle with it because I love Burrick. I love him. I love him just so much. And part of my problem with Molly is she got to marry Burrick and we never got to see the real grief. We never got to see that family grieve for the loss of Burrick. And I think that's where the disconnect comes. Because we don't see that grief for Burrick, it's almost like he got swept away and isn't important. And in comes Fitz. And that just feels wrong. It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel...
There's a whole,
I'm not okay with it.
There is a whole untold story there.
Yes, there is.
All those decades with Molly and Burrick getting together, settling down, raising a family, all of that it happens off the page.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I mean, we see glimpses of it. We see glimpses of it in Fitz's skilling. We see glimpses of it in flashback via Nettle. We see bits of it in the way Burrick talks to Swift. So we get a sense that things actually have been pretty sweet. You know, once the horses were brought back to him after the war and he was able to begin breeding the horses and make a name for himself in doing that, their family clearly did pretty well. You know, they were well-to-do as far as their standing in the community. They were happy. Their older kids were courting. They, you know, there was a. They felt very embedded in their community, like any family becomes. I liked that.
Which, thinking on it now, it's probably from Molly's perspective that the decision to eventually get back with Fitz doesn't make that much sense. And obviously, I don't know how I would feel. If in, you know, my kids are now, 4 and 7, if in 10 years' time, circumstance, and then my ex-wife came around, and it's like, now, like, I am so...
I've moved on.
a different person, like, or maybe I'm not a different person, but I've got a whole other life that I lived that, like...
Yeah.
Our paths have done that, and the fact that... No, they really are not going to reconnect anymore. You know.
I did struggle with it a lot, and Evie actually brought me around considerably when she said, "All of your issues with why Fitz loves Molly, why Molly loves Fitz is Fitz's fault. He doesn't share himself with Molly properly. He doesn't tell her all of the facets of who he is. So at the end of Tournyman." When Molly is grieving, Molly's been given Withywoods, so she's moved away from this community where she and Burrick had their family. So she's now in this new place with her children and realised Fitz is alive. Now they get to know each other through letters over the space of a couple of years. And then he goes to see her and visits many times with nothing happening between them. And they actually regain that friendship they had as children. And that spark that was always there is rekindled. This isn't a couple who separated because of differences. This is a teenage passionate affair that ended in tragedy, that was, you know, heartbreaking, and the man I loved vanished, and, you know, and for him to suddenly appear again as a hero who sacrificed himself to save the kingdom, that's a bit different than your ex-wife coming back. You know, this is somebody that you just, oh, he was my first love, and he's the father of my daughter, and he's a hero. And so I sort of started to come around and go, okay, yeah, I can get behind this. Still not okay that we didn't get enough grief for Beric, but okay, I can see it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm prepared to go with it. But it did take me a long time.
Yeah. Sorry, just got
awesome.
Erin saying hi. Yeah, obviously, come back to the conversation when you're done. And then Drew is around. And yeah,
I don't know. Oh, yeah, I'm working on it.
I don't good at all. But it is there. And we'll
I see like the beard.
But I think, are we going to put a bit of criticism here? That sort of getting back together between Morley and Fitz is not that well executed.
I think it was, I mean, knowing where the story goes, it's important that this happens. And it closes off the forging slash loss of memory slash lack of drive that we had with Fitz when he gets his memories back, that now suddenly, yes, he's regained that passion, and yes, he wants to go and fight for Molly and do the things. But you also can't spend hundreds of pages on falling action without losing your readers. So there's always that balance that I don't know that got right, where we needed it, but we maybe, I don't know how, I mean, how else could she have done it? It's either going to be too rushed where no one believes it, or too slow that you just lose everybody.
So I'm going to answer your question and then you tell me what you think. So I agree that after all the action and the ending of Tournament, you can spend a couple of hundred pages building this up, because it would be just such an anticlimax for the whole thing. But equally, jumping ahead, we spend a whole book in Fitz and the Fool setting up the story. And my God, that first, what was it called? The first book in
Fool's Assassin.
Fool's Assassin is a slow,
slow
book, right? It is, forgive me for this, I don't really mean it, but it's Wheel of Time slog type book.
Like
superior quality, and not quite there, but there's a whole lot of nothing happening in Fool's Assassin, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can say that about Fool's Errand. Literally nothing happens for over half of the book. He doesn't even leave the cabin until, you know, the final third.
We'll save all those things for two conversations time.
Yeah, this is something Hob does, and that you are welcomed back into the story. We get caught up with where everybody is. We lay all of the foundation, and it will get paid off later. It's that whole, you will be rewarded for reading that, and it will gain more context, and it will gain depth the more you read. And that, I think, is where, And I this is a guess because I've never read Wheel of Time, where I would guess that isn't necessarily the case with Wheel of Time.
Don't even bother. Don't go there.
Okay. Okay.
Done.
Okay.
You are better off rereading Elderlings for the 54th time.
Yeah, that's what I figure.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, honestly. So it is, I think it's fair to say that for anyone who is reading Elderlings, like Erin there, that if you finish Tournament and you're not fed up, and I don't see a reason why you'd be fed up, or, you know, if it's taking you 9 books to figure out this is not for you, you are in. You're going to go all the way.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it?
I think that's safe to say. And I have said to people in the past, if you're not loving it, if you're reading it because everybody else is reading it and they think it's great, and you're like, okay, don't continue. If you don't love these books, don't read them. This is something we do for love. This is something we should be enjoying. The fear of missing out is not worth it if you're not having fun.
Absolutely.
As much as I want everyone to love these books, not everybody's going to.
Yeah. And I think after this, I didn't experience the same doubts that I had with whether to read Lightship or not. Like, it's wonderful. I want to know what happens to them. But after Lightship, it's like, no, I really want to go back.
I want to see what's happening over there.
I want to go back to the Rain Wilds. And obviously, and she does this throughout, she gives you hints of what to in Rain Wilds, isn't it? She references what's happening to the dragons there. Yes. She plants that seed almost casually in a conversation. And then you go, what did you just say?
Hang on a minute. Wait a minute.
Yeah. And then the conversation moves on and fits on the full go and blah, blah, blah. And you go, oh, hang on, you know. And then I think, again, for me, Rain Wilds picked it up relative to Tony Mann. But that's, again, the next conversation.
Again, like I said, and that's very much a question of managing expectations. You know, people, unless you know the history of the series, you can go, okay, you finish Tawny Man and then you read Rain Wilds. It's one series. And if you aren't aware that Tawny Man closes an arc and Rain Wilds is the beginning of a new one, it is a shock, that pacing difference.
You got a question there from Drew.
Things to look out for. Things to look out for, or which books benefited the most from a reread? Assassin's Quest, absolutely, improves the most on a reread. It's often the book that people struggle with the most in Farseer, because it's a chonker and a half, and a lot of things seem to happen for no reason, and then the end is fairly rushed. But if you continue, all of those things that just seemed like a waste of page space suddenly have depth and now have meaning, and the end is filled out for you as the series progresses. So when you go back and reread, Assassin's Quest reads like a very different book because you have context for everything that's going on, and the meaning of so many interactions has changed significantly. So that's absolutely the one that benefits best from reread. And as for stuff to look out for, it's a bit tricky because when you're reading The Realm of the Elderlings, you're reading the stories that are in front of you. And often it's only when you get to the very last book that you remember that the series is called Realm of the Elderlings and that all of the books are actually about the Elderlings and that relationship. And so when you go back and reread, now you get that layer. You don't just get that, okay, we're doing Fitz, doing this coming of age, doing this, live ships, we're doing this in the dragons. But underneath the whole time has been the Elderlings storyline. And you get to read that more fully the second time round, which, I mean, reading 16 books, this amazing, to get to read them again and have it be like a whole new story, it's like two series for the price of one. And both of them are excellent quality. I can't recommend a reread highly enough. It's so worth it.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I agree with you because, like I said earlier, my appreciation for the first trilogy has grown as a more later on. I think a lot of people maybe read the first trilogy and decide it's not for them because, you know, we agree that the ending feels rushed and sort of and maybe, I mean, the thing that then makes me wonder, because Robin Hood didn't start with the whole thing.
No.
It sort of kind of grew organically. So as an ending book, Assassin's Quest isn't that great. As it, that,
no.
If you had been left at that, that trilogy would have been pretty poppy, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been great.
But I think it got, I want to say it got saved, but it certainly got improved by everything she wrote.
Absolutely. And I think that's why I do try really hard to point out to people that Farcia is usually ranked fourth of the five sub-series that make up Realm of the Elderlings. Farcia usually is the one that sits just above Rainwilds. And I know that that's not been your experience. I know that you rank them differently, but mostly that's where it sits. And that can help a lot of readers. They're like, oh, okay, so it, pretty much everything else is stronger. Great. And, of course, by the time you've read further into the series, your appreciation for Farcia has changed, because it does. And that reward for continuing, not a lot of authors can pull off. It's like, okay, well, they actually haven't improved as writers sufficiently to lift those previous books. Hobb does. I mean, leaps and bounds, you can watch her growth in writing this epic series, that by the time you get to the last book, the whole thing is so much better. Because yeah. Right up until that last book, you're still learning, you're still getting context for things that happen incredibly early in the series. And that, to me, is just astonishing that she's able to do that.
Completely going off topic sure. change, something else. Why not?
Yeah.
Getting a little bit sort of nerdy here with the fantasy.
Yeah.
We actually have three magic systems in Elderlings. We've got the wit, the mm-hmm. skill, and yeah. then we've got the hex magic, right?
Yeah.
And not a lot is mentioned or talked about this hex magic. Mm. But I think in Tournament there's a couple of references, because Fitz goes to visit a hedge witch and stuff like that, right? And sometimes I think that hedge magic seems to be a bit sort of overpowered, and why don't people use it a lot more than they do in the series? I don't know if it's a bit of a plot hole there.
I don't know that it is a hole, because it is discussed several times throughout the series. And Fitz touches on it in the epigraphs to each chapter, where he talks about magics and he talks about the range of magics and how within that range the skill and the wit are in opposition, whereas scrying and hedge witches kind of butt up against each other. And so there's more than just those. You've got the scrying, you've got foretelling, you've got lots of little magics are mentioned throughout the books, but because Fitz doesn't have them, we don't examine it a lot.
Mm.
We do hear about people who have had a charm, a love charm or a love potion, and you hear of people visiting Jinnah for love matches, fortune telling, all of these things. And if Fitz had spent more time in Buck, we may have seen more. But because he spends so much of his life in isolation, and even later when he lives, you know, in his own manor, he's still quite isolated. He's not part of a urban population that rubs shoulders with magic users, that has, you know, a hedge witch, a palm reader in one shop, and maybe half a dozen shops further down you might have somebody who, I don't know, sells dream herbs for fortune telling. I don't think it's so much a plot hole as a doorway that we haven't looked through yet.
But because it exists, and because it is quite powerful, I would have expected other characters in the series to make use of it.
Mm.
And no one does. Like, Shade doesn't ever...
No, he does. Shade uses scrying in the Farcia. So we do see instances of it. Again, I think because it's Fitz, we are very limited by what we see of the greater world around him that isn't immediately affecting him. But the door is there, and I feel that should the world ever be revisited, oh God, please, then that's a door we could explore later. We may not, but that's a door that there's more in there. And I would quite like to know. But because it's not been essential to the story, we haven't had any sort of further building on it.
And talking about Shade, mm-hmm. it's a character that goes through a bit of a personality change between Farseer and Tournyman, isn't it? Because he was the kind of wise sage guide slash mentor, father figure, instructor. Mm-hmm. And by the time that Tournyman comes around, he's sort of quite relatively obsessed with scaling and wanting to and doing sort of relatively non-intelligent things, which kind of is a slightly different character from what he was in the first trilogy.
I think that's a reflection on the fact that he's that mentor role, but we don't often see the hero, in our instance, Fitz, still have a relationship with them when they're an adult. With that mentor, usually the mentor gets killed in some, you know, moment that's powerful and provides growth for our hero. We don't get that yet. Shade. Yeah. So we get that change in perspective, and we get Fitz interacting with Shade as an adult and being able to see the flaws in somebody he previously just looked up to. And one of the things that he discovers is that Shade is obsessive. But we did see that in Farseer, those tendencies to get super focused on something to the exclusion of everything else. We did see that in Farseer. Now we're seeing it from an adult perspective and seeing how unhealthy that can be. But yeah, that's exactly the point, Jennifer. Yeah, the things that he shows more openly in Tournyman, he just wasn't able to in Farseer. We see that he's quite vain. We see that he's quite enamored of shiny things. he's a bit of a popinjay, and he could never be that when he was the man behind the wall. When he came forward and he was highly regarded and he was highly placed at court, suddenly now he can dress himself in the fancy, rich, jewel-coloured clothes, and he can have the jewellery, and he can have all of the things that go with being the advisor to the Queen. And he really likes it. Like, he really likes it. And he becomes a bit of a player. And ladies like him. Yeah, not a bad thing. And I'm okay with that. And I like that he's flawed. I like that he's obsessive. I like that he becomes so focused he stops being able to see that he shouldn't be doing the thing, because to me that makes him more of that mad scientist kind of thing than a wise counselor. I see him as that sort of slightly deranged older bloke that's like, no, I figured it out, I've got to do this. I kind of like that for him. It makes him more interesting for a start, and you know, that's always good for a series.
I don't know, maybe I'm making another leap of interpretation here, but there seems to be a lot of imagery about coming out of the closet, of being sort of not able to express your true self throughout the whole series, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, and Tournyman is very strong in that thing.
Tournyman's very strong in that, that we get a lot of that as well in Rain Wild Chronicles. Mm-hmm. Not so much in the last trilogy, but there is a lot of very tactfully done undercurrent about just self-identity in general. I don't want to pigeonhole it down just to one thing.
Yeah, that freedom to express your true self being a key part of becoming happy is all the way through the series and is focused quite heavily in Tournyman, of being true to yourself, of being who you are supposed to be, and accepting that. And not, was it Fool Says? Fool says, what part of me would you like to chop off? Because you can't accept all of this. Which part have I got to remove for you to accept me? And that really rings true, I think, for a lot of people, in that if you love me, if you care for me in any way, then you have to be able to encompass all of me. And if you can't, that's not a fault in me. That's on you. And Fitz slow, because he's not bright. It takes him a while, but he gets there. He gets there. He realizes that, oh, okay, yeah, I'm actually wrong. And I need to be sorry. I need to apologize in a big way here. He represents a lot of people, I think that they're doing really well. They're like, no, I'm very accepting. I can deal with all of these changes. I'm a good person. Who, when confronted with actually having to accept something, struggle. Mm. And I think it's important to see in fiction that you're allowed to struggle. It's okay to find change difficult, but do it anyway and see the flaw in yourself and try and overcome that.
Yeah, no, it was just addressing the point from before. We did talk about it, but since we kind
briefly.
Of briefly.
And but it was also, as you, it was very beautiful, because something that may have been missed is at this point in the story, Fool has been believing that every time Fitz brings up the breakfast tray, he's also bringing him flowers. So Fool has spent several months thinking that Fitz knows, like properly understands the level of Fool's love for him, because he's been giving him flowers. And so that conversation, when he realizes that these aren't from you, are they? That he's been enjoying a relationship that actually wasn't there. He's very hurt in that discussion. Jennifer's right. But I also agree with Fool in saying, why would I have told you this? I already know that this would have been the reaction. Why would I have told you that? And that's the contempt that we show our old friends. We take so much for granted that we don't actually give them the chance to have that reaction and move past it. We just assume that reaction and so never deal with it. Mm. And those are the things that hurt relationships. So I'm glad that they had that discussion. I mean, they needed to have it. So the argument is, it's a big deal, because they're both making assumptions. Fool has assumed that Fitz is totally okay with this, because Fool believes he's been getting flowers from Fitz for months. And Fitz believes that Fool has lied to him for how long? Suddenly the only person in his life that he's ever trusted isn't even real. And so he falls back into that trauma response of, nobody loves me, nobody cares, I'm on my own.
Although admittedly, they don't quite get over it, because we go back to that in Fitz and the Fool. And again, a conversation for later, but clearly there's still unresolved issues, because the whole Amber Fool duality becomes another point of argument.
That's right.
Well, remains a point of argument between them for the whole of Fitz and the Fool.
Yeah, and I have thoughts on that we can discuss later. But I appreciated in Tawny Man that Fool was unabashed. He was like, no, Amber is part of me. The same as Golden is part of me. The same as Fool is part of me. They're all me. None of them is a lie. They're all me, and you can't deal with that. And I was happy to accommodate that by not bringing these parts of myself into your life. But we're grown-ups now, and could you just, you know, see all of me and be okay with that, instead of my having to cut pieces of myself away? And Fitz does struggle with it. And I like that we see his struggle with it. It makes him real.
And again, just going back to this, but I don't think, maybe put this quarrel aside, no other fantasy series deals with human relationships and emotions to this depth and these in this kind of level, isn't it? Beyond what may be just a relationship between two characters. I don't think I've read anything. Obviously, I'm not that well read, but I haven't encountered
anything. No, I agree with you. And again, if we separate Discworld, because that's its own thing, is this isn't just a, oh, we have a non-binary character, full stop, that end. We explore these relationships really deeply. We look at the relationships that Amber has with Jack, with Althea, with Brashen. And Amber is a complete person. Amber is, she's not a front. She's not a costume. This is literally a person who is a facet of who we know as the Fool, in the same way that Fool is a facet of this character. So Beloved, as we come to know them, is all of those characters combined, where all that's done is kind of highlighted something that happens in the real world, where you might have somebody who's closeted, but within their safe community, they can be that person. But they have to put that person away when they have to go out into their job, perhaps, or to deal with older relatives, perhaps, and they have to put on a different face for those people. They're still those people. There's no lying happening to either group of people. You're simply showing a different facet of yourself. And I think Fool, Amber, Lord Golden is a beautiful way of expressing that everybody does this. Everybody has these facets we show other people. And the people who know the more facets of you are the ones who love you the most. They're the ones who have seen you be son, brother, cousin, teacher, friend, husband. They've seen all of those different facets of you and gone, yeah, I like this guy. He's pretty cool. Whereas other people who don't know you as well maybe only know you as teacher and would be surprised to meet the version of you who is cousin because they could be different.
Although, so two things that like very quickly. One, like, because, yeah, like I've encountered homosexual characters in other fantasy books, but it's more like, so he's homosexual or lesbian, is it? Okay. It bears no relevance to the story. It doesn't really matter. It's a sort of a very sort of tokenistic thing to do. Whereas here, it does definitely get explored. It definitely presents questions and possibilities and so on. But now that you were making all those points, sort of started to find the Fool a little bit irritating because this almost, I don't want to say perfect character, but it's a character that is so comfortable with himself.
Yeah.
That annoying, because me personally, I'm crippled by self-doubt day in, day out in all the aspects that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much in my job, I feel more comfortable, but certainly my wife, as a father,
minute in, minute out,
I'm second guessing myself. I'm wondering, you know, as a husband and all that kind of, whereas the Fool is like, he's cool with everything. Everything is fine. I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other. And it's like, no, that's almost a too perfect a character.
I think that's why I like Fool particularly in Tournyman, because you do get that. And for me, it's like, well, why wouldn't you? If you're a prophet and you've seen so many outcomes, well, of course you're going to be that. You'd be like, well, I can do this because I already know how this is going to go. And we see the flip side of that at the end of Tournyman when Fitz recovers him to his body, them to their body, and the fear that we see in that moment in Fool, because he doesn't know now. He doesn't know what's going to happen now. And he's genuinely frightened because I've never seen this. I don't know what to do here. And you see that insecurity in that moment and you see his panic that I don't know what I need to be now to survive, to exist, to move forward. And it is the first time, it's the first time that we see Fool uncertain, because right up till that point, he's always known how it's going to go. Yeah. He's very vulnerable at this point because he's never seen beyond it. He doesn't have any goal. He doesn't have anything to give his existence a framework, where before he did. It was, okay, get to the next point that is a better point. Make the next change. And he knew what those changes would be as he got there. And now he doesn't have it. And he's properly frightened. And that comes across really clearly. As to what happens later, again, that's a discussion for another day.
But yeah. I suppose that's a fairly natural, like, particularly you see a lot of that with athletes, isn't it?
Yes.
For all the time and effort to get to the top or the pinnacle or whatever it is they're trying to do. And they've always said that staying there is harder than getting there.
Yeah.
So, like, because all this thing that has been giving you drive and meaning and purpose, once you get there, it may not be all you hoped for, or it may be, but now.
And also when they've completed their athletic career and you see them going, well, now what?
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with myself.
You've defined yourself so much around achieving something.
Yeah.
Either you need to find the next thing, or you are a little bit lost, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that we see that in full at the end, where he literally just has no clue what to do now. That doesn't change the fact that, yes, full can be annoying.
Yeah.
Because that sense that he gives of always knowing is really annoying. It's like, can you not be lost like the rest of us? Can you not feel a little bit worried about what might happen?
So. Admit, it's only in hindsight now. While reading the books, you don't get that, because I think pretty much up to the ending of Tournament, he remains this sort of figure of mystery. There's always a shroud of question marks around who he is, what he is. That helps not think too much about what he's being like or what he's like, and then to go, you're a bit annoying, mate.
It's like, okay, but you're interestingly annoying, so we'll put up with it. Because he is interesting, and you, particularly in Tournament, we see with Jinna's charms when she talks about how affected he was with the bird charms, particularly. And you sort of start thinking, that's right, because he's told us so many times he's not human. And his reactions to Jinna's charms prove this. And yes, I think a lot of people are angry with Fool for that. And I also see the logic of it, because he'd moved past his time, according to his own prophecies. His catalyst had made such a catalytic change to the future, he didn't know what was going to happen next. And the concept that just being around Fitz would continue to cause changes makes sense to me. And for Fool not to want to do that because he doesn't know where those choices are going to go also makes sense to me. Like, I imagine they would be like, okay, can you give me some time to dream new dreams so I know what we're doing? And,
That puts the question there, whether obviously the Fool is using Fitz to a degree to achieve whatever it is. And once they get there, we find out later that once the prophets fulfill whatever it was, they have to go back to Island.
Well, they should.
Whose name sort of escapes me now. And it's a sort of fairly utilitarian view of people, isn't it? And that's irritating, because clearly there is a bond between them that then turns out like he cannot get past his professionalism and just, continue.
We did get a couple of minutes of it in the series where Fool has said, I hate that you're my catalyst because I have to do this. I hate that you're my friend and I've got to keep trying to kill you. I don't like it. And I think it's a bit like, I don't know, being blonde. He can't help that he's the prophet, and he can't help that his catalyst is Fitz. They talk about how unusual it is for them to be such close friends, because the catalyst and the prophet usually have a more tension-driven relationship. So does that factor into the scale of change Fitz can make? I don't know. Maybe. We there's definitely a sense of guilt that I get from Fool, that he has to put Fitz through so many things. Like, he doesn't want to do it. He really doesn't. He's like, I tried to leave you alone, is what he says at the opening of Fool's Errand. I tried to let you have a quiet life. I tried. But we have to do it again. Sorry. it's gonna be really hard, and it's gonna be harder than last time. And I hate that I have to do this to you, but we're gonna need to do this. I liked the conflict within Fool for that.
Yeah. I mean, the relationship
and patience.
The relationship between Nighteyes and Fitz is a completely different one, isn't it?
It's beautiful. I love the relationship.
It's gonna jump back to again to completely
By all means.
So we discover, and again, is it here in Toniman? We discover Prilcop is the previous prophet, and his catalyst was this evil witch queen thing, right? Or am I remembering wrong? It was the Outlanders king, wasn't it?
I don't actually remember who Prilcop's catalyst was. All I remember is that when he finished his changing of the futures and his catalyst was lost, he had a very, very far, narrow possibility vision of somebody bringing down the Pale Woman. So he just stayed there waiting on the off chance that that future came to fruition. So he just waited on the island. Too frightened to instigate change, because as the prophet, that's not his job, but to allow the next prophet to come with their catalyst. So when Fool and Fitz show up, Prilcop is immediately drawn to them. We see it in the fact that he claims their token. The Out Islanders are very distressed that the token that they left for the black man wasn't taken. And nobody clicks that he's taken the honey from Fitz's tent, but he did. So he took their offering. Immediately he's connected to them. Immediately he's drawn to them. We see him not help so much as allow them to help each other. He doesn't show Fitz anything except where Fool is. And then only after Fitz has made his changes does Prilcop become involved and say, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, this is why I was here. And now I can help Fool, because I know what it is to live past your destinies that you've seen. And the naivety in him, because we never learn how old he is, but he's really old, is that he thinks he's going to go back and fix whatever was wrong with the school that sent out the Pale Woman.
If I'm remembering, it's all read a few years ago. So it's the Pale Woman that gave the king of the Out Islanders the magic to forge people in Fasir, isn't it?
What happened with the Pale Woman is that she formed contacts many years previously with Galen and Regal, and had bought from them the skills scroll collections. And we learn in Tawny Man that she had a little bit of talent with the skill, and she learned lots of ways to use it, among them how to sort of use the memory stone, which was how we were forging people. She also learned enough to partially forge people, which gave us her army, if you like, of soulless people who still could be given commands and who would still do as they're told. And in failing by not winning the war, she fed Keeble to the stone dragon, not understanding how it took a united purpose to quicken a stone dragon. Merely filling it with memory and emotion wasn't enough. There had to be a cohesive drive. What are we trying to achieve? Which they don't get until she is partially forged into the dragon and that it takes her hands. And it's at that point where it's got Cable and it's got part of her and that rage for specifically these people on this island, specifically here to kill the dragon. That's when you get the quickening of Cable's dragon, because now there's a conjoined purpose. And so while she never gave Cable any magic, her awareness of what could be done with her skill and the memory stone was enough to get a lot of people lost. And I think the tragedy is when Fitz finds the stones at the beach and he's like, I've just found our people, you know, all of those people that we lost during the war who were forged, I've just found them, they're here. The tragedy of that is unspeakable.
That's right. Okay. That makes sense. Thank you. Do you see, that's why I need to talk to you. that's what it is. Right. I think, unless we're going to take the conversation off in somewhere.
Well, I do think that we have missed talking about Night Eyes, because we lost Night Eyes early in Tawny Man, but he's such a presence in the trilogy that, no worries, Evie. You know, he's such a fundamental part of the story that not talking about Night Eyes would be rude. I think that it was beautifully done.
Yes.
Even though it breaks my heart every time.
That moment is very poignant. But again, when we talk about Fitz and the Fool, we will have to talk about Night Eyes, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's gone.
He's gone, but not forgotten.
Yes.
That's probably what we can say at this point. The Fool's Errand is my favourite of all of the books in the series. And a lot of that is because we get such a big lot of time with Fitz at the beginning, at the cabin, just refreshing everybody's memories about what we love about him. Mm. And with Night Eyes. And again, even though it's the most devastating loss I think I've ever read in a book, losing Night Eyes is also one of the most beautiful moments I've ever read in a book. So we get, at the one end, we get the beauty of his friendship with Fool, which we don't actually get anywhere else. We don't get to see them just be friends and hang out. So I liked that we got that. We got to see Shade being proud of him for creating really cool ink and like just being an old teacher who's proud of a student who's done well. So I really liked the gentleness of that re-immersion into Fitz's world. And then to go all the way through the story and end with such a brutal, almost pointless battle, and to lose Night Eyes just breaks my heart every time. Like, I start crying chapters in advance now because I know it's coming, and it gets no easier, and by the time it rolls around I am a mess. Like, I'm a snotty, blotchy I am not an attractive crier, and I'm a mess every single, and I know it's coming. Like, I should be inured to it by now. I am not. It is always devastating.
Yeah, it's very much, you do know it's coming, isn't it? You know it's coming.
Oh, yes. She tells you so many times in that book that he's old, he's coming to an end, he's ready to go. He's told Fitz, I'm ready to go. And don't hold me back.
Mm. And it's, we talked about this in the past, isn't it? Where I've always said, half seriously, that Robin Hobb is the secret grim dark writer, because if she needs to pull her characters through hell, if she needs to make them go through a tough time, if she has to, you know, she will.
And you're going to feel it. you're going to feel it with them.
And I unapologetically, you know, she'd just do it. And I think that gets cranked up in the last trilogy.
Yeah. I just think that losing Night Eyes, and for Dutiful to lose his cat, and for that to be so devastating to both of them, and yet have both of them needing to carry on like nothing happened, was really just incredibly written, because the world does expect that of us when we lose someone we love, whether it's a parent or a spouse or a child or a pet, people that you really, really love. When we lose them, the world still expects us to go to work tomorrow. The world still expects us to go to school. It expects that we're going to be able to carry on. And most people don't even notice that we've suffered that loss. So watching Dutiful, watching Fitz negotiate that as we move forward into Golden Fall is actually really, it's a powerful thing if you've ever felt grief yourself, because you recognize it. You're like, yes, they're grieving and it's hard. And then we get that beautiful scene at the beginning of Golden Fall where Ketchikan grieves with Fitz. And that one always gets me as well. And I don't even, trying to think, can I say it without crying? I'm not sure. But she says, but she says, I'm going to cry. She says, I felt him go, Fitz. I felt Night Eyes leave us. And that she felt it, that she grieved for Night Eyes was powerful for me. Mm. Yeah. Wait for you? Not likely. A lot of people have to reread that scene because they're like, that's not what just happened. And they have to read it again and go, oh my God, that just happened. And it's so, so beautiful because you get that sense that Night Eyes is okay. He's free and he's happy to go where he's going, and he's not going to wait for Fitz, but he'll be there when Fitz's time is up. And there's a beauty to that. Again, if you've ever felt grief for anybody, there's that sense of acceptance where you've let them go, and they've needed you to let them go to go. And it's beautiful.
Although it all depends on how it happens. Because I lost when I was a child growing up, I only had one set of grandparents. My mother's parents died before I was born, or when I was very young. I grew up with my father's parents, and they left in very different. One was unexpected.
Oh, that's hard.
The other one was a long goodbye. So the approach, you know, you approach those two things and they affect you very differently. I think, you know, in Night Eyes' case, you know it's coming. You've got time to make your peace with it as much as you can, because
that's right.
These things aren't easy. And I think people are a lot more accepting, and they find that a lot easier to deal with when it's, when you've
foreshadowed
to prepare for it. That's
right. Yeah. Yeah, it's not as difficult as when it's sudden, and sudden is far more shocking and produces far greater trauma. And this one, obviously, if something like that had happened, I think I would have rioted. I'm like, no, you cannot just do that to Night Eyes. No.
Yeah.
Thankfully, she didn't, and we did get Night Eyes living a very long life, a mostly happy life, and being okay with going when it was time. And I think that it helped that the battle was over. I think it helped that it was in a quiet moment. It wasn't high tension. And he went in his sleep. I liked that was the case, because it felt like he'd gone, okay, got you through that last battle, and now I can go.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely sense of relief to that, even as I'm crying ugly. I literally get a hangover after Fool's Errand because I get dehydrated from crying. I'm getting better though. I'm getting better at making sure I have enough water to drink, and because I seriously, the hangover is real.
Right.
It's an emotional hangover that presents physically.
Yeah. No, I do have that reaction, but it's with other series, other characters. I think the relationship between Night Eyes and Fitz was very strong and very believable and very real. His relationship with Ketchikan and the Fool, I don't know. I always felt it wasn't that well developed. There, just my perspective. I know they share that moment in Farsia trilogy, Night Eyes and Ketchikan, but throughout, you spend a lot of time with those two together.
Yes, that's right. It remains possibly one of my, seems weird to say it, favorite death scenes. It's because it is so beautifully done. It's done with a really light touch. Like you don't feel a sense of dread or horror or fear. It's incredibly peaceful, incredibly beautiful. And you're just left with that emptiness that Fitz feels. So the following chapters where Fitz is kind of in a dream, that's how you feel as the reader. You're like, I can't process anything right now. We just lost Night Eyes. I'm not coping. So that it takes a couple of chapters for Fitz to really come back to himself works for me really, really well. So I liked that.
Just to parallel that back to one of the things we were talking about before, clearly Robin Hobb, Elderlings, Magnum Opus, I don't know how old she is, but clearly, you know, she's going to qualify for a bus.
70, I think. Yeah.
It's not already. Does she retire from writing? What is she going to do now?
Well, I know she's writing at the moment. She's being very mysterious about what she's writing, but she made a very an oblique hint in her on her website where she finished off a post with to be or not to be, with two E's. And I'm like, oh, please be. Whether that comes to fruition, I don't know. I will continue to hope, even if all we get is a novella or a short story or, I don't know, half a paragraph telling us something. I will be happy. But she is still writing. I imagine that she will continue to write until, well, she can't. But at the moment, she can still write and she is still producing work.
Right.
Fingers crossed that it will be.
It'll be difficult, I suppose, to step away from. I'm sure that part of her, a bit like Abercrombie with the First World Universe, he's doing something totally different now. Like, you know, he's written 9 books plus a novella, probably quite, as a writer, quite wanting to get away from that. But I suppose in the back of your mind, with the fear that you are known as the Elderlings writer, and and that you should write Elderlings because that's what made your name, and that's what people recognize you for, it's a risk.
Yeah.
I think in music as well, many artists, they are afraid of changing because your fan base.
Yeah, that's right.
To a large degree, accepting of that change, isn't it?
I think part of why Hobb doesn't become stagnant in the realm of the Elderlings is the characters quite clearly have an existence outside of the page for her, because they're the ones that come back and say to her, I've actually got some more story to tell. So they clearly have an existence in her mind. She's not having to struggle to find stories based in that world. I think if anything, she probably struggles to write outside that world and would like to. And instead has these characters in her head going, ah, but you haven't finished telling my story. So I, as a fan of her writing, it's like, write what you want to write. As a fan of Realm of the Elderlings, please write about that. So that's I don't know if that makes me a toxic fan, but yeah.
I don't know.
It's certainly my dream.
I think from my side of things. I am, as always, very grateful for your conversation and for your insight into the whole series, but this particular trilogy.
Thank you.
We've got at least a couple more conversations pending, isn't
always.
It?
Always, always happy to talk Robin Hobb, but I don't only read Hobb, like I do read other books too.
But funnily enough, I was thinking about, God, I need to carry on this. And it was you who emailed me like, hey, you know, I've moved, I'm ready, whatever you want. It was all fairly quickly organized, isn't it?
Yeah, like I said, I love talking about these books. I like that everybody I talk to brings a new point of view, and I get to see other things that I've through a different lens, and that's so important to do that. And that I can, even after all of the rereads I've done, still find new ways to look at things is amazing. I love it. So thank you always for inviting me, because I really genuinely appreciate it. It's
so
really
what are you reading?
Who am I reading now? I actually am reading, I've joined the reread of A Song of Ice and Fire for Joanna, who's doing that. So I'm reading Clash of Kings at the moment. And I just joined my local library. Which pile is it? This pile is all from my library. And they're all beautiful editions from, who is it? From... that's a subterranean. That's a Subterranean Press edition, guys, at my library. Numbered and everything. Numbered and signed. So I'm reading a John Scalzi novel. Well, I'm not. It's a collection of short stories. And I have a bunch of Adrian Tchaikovsky stuff. Again, Subterranean Press novels, signed, numbered, at my library. How cool is my library?
Yeah.
So. I'm happy with that. I've got lots to go. I've got plenty to read. This
Fantastic.
What about you? What have you got on the pile at the moment?
Well, this year I'm doing the Sun Eater series with Ian. So next week we're having the discussion of the first book, and I've got the novella and the next book waiting there. But we're doing one every 2 months. And then I've started, but this is ridiculous. So all of that shelf there is The Legend of Drizzt by R.A. Salvatore.
Oh, okay.
And I've got, but the problem is, I think I am on book 24, I think, right? 24 books. But it's one of those things, I was thinking about it the other day, like, they're not great. You know, we were talking about knowing when to finish, right? That should have finished 10 books ago. Salvatore, all he seems to be able to do is write Dungeons and Dragons and The Dark Elf. But I was thinking about it. I started reading that before I moved to the UK. So, showing my interest in that in 90, it must have been 95 or thereabout.
Goodness me.
And then when I arrived, so I've read the first trilogy, I've read it in publication order. When I got to the UK in 98, I discovered that there was another trilogy. It's like, oh my God, there's another trilogy. Pick it up, and I've been reading Dark Elf basically all my adult life, and every so often, and he's published a new trilogy, so I'm like 10 books behind. But you know, the whole thing is done. This is just churning them out because he cannot do anything else. But I've realized that for better or for worse, it's such a part of my of my life that I kind of feel obliged to even though I don't particularly rate them anymore, even though I think, you know, this is not great, but
there's also the hope though that the thing that made you love it is still going to show up.
And I've literally left easily 10 years between the last book I read and picking up the tetralogy I'm reading now, because like I said, there's about 30 something books in there.
Oh wow.
Yeah, anyway, so there's that, yeah. Weirdly.
Fun times. Well, I hope you find something in there that rekindles the joy.
I think it's more, it does remind me of, you know, when I was a teenager, it's very, fairly socially awkward kid, and I just spend my whole weekends playing Dungeons and Dragons, you know, because you did that, then you're going to read these books, right? And, you know, part of me still misses those times. And really, I started playing role-playing games again, but now I've found a bunch of middle-aged dads just like me, so we play online. And
yep.
The only time we start playing like at 10 at night, because that's when the kids are in bed, and that's the only time.
Yep.
Really, so it's not quite the same, but it does scratch the age, so to speak.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I'm glad you can do that, and that's awesome. So thank you. I just thank you again for wanting to talk to me about this, because I love it so much.
Thank you.
We will have to find an overlap of something else soon and see what else we can chinwag about. So
for sure.
Absolutely.
Yes, and thank Jennifer and Shadia and Drew.
Yeah.
And say hello. Thank you very much for the contributions and the conversation. And
absolutely.
Take care, everyone. See you soon.
Bye.